Okay, so we've got some time now for some Q&A. Thank you so much, Mark. That was wonderful.
The desire for control. I mean, I'm all about control. Where does that desire come from?
I have no idea. It's just, I think it's part of the mystery of evil, part of the mystery of original sin. I mean, if you picture the garden, I mean, I pictured Adam and Eve as just being overwhelmed by the chaos, the beautiful and wonderful chaos. And there arises within this and this desire to bring it under some manageable control. Where does that come from? I don't know. And to bring it into some order that is not meant to be, an order that's not meant to be. Obviously, one of the things I'm doing with the passage is I'm flipping it on its head. Most people use it as most exegetes. In fact, I'm a little scared about my interpretation because I didn't find anyone who interpreted it this way. Everyone says, isn't it marvelous how it shows that there's order in creation? 7 days and things happen in an orderly way and there's these different orders of creation. And there is that, no question about it. But the thing that struck me as I kept on reading it was how utterly chaotic it is. Just walk down a city street in New York, you'll see how chaotic life is. It's amazingly lush and full. And so there's something in the human. Maybe if I could be a little paradoxical, I think part of the desire for order and control is part of the divine image in us, a desire to bring things into order. I mean, Paul talks about we're not to worship in a wild way. We're supposed to worship decently and ordered. It's a good thing to have order. So in some sense, original sin arises out of a good thing. And I mean, that's one of the things that I think is really important to see about sin. It always arises out of a really good motive. Not always, but a lot of times it's a really good motive. It's a really good thing people are after. They're just going about it the wrong way. They're wanting to be in control of the order and in the process and not letting God do it.
Mark, I'm going to tempt you with a hypothetical situation of giving you control. You talked about worship and kind of our experience in churches. And if you were in charge of churches, and you because I sense the tension that you talk about in kind of our happy, uplifting services that may feel a little superficial sometimes, unaware of the powers that we're dabbling in. And the temptation maybe would be to go onto this other side where it's very somber and very serious and almost hyper-aware of what's going on. If you were in charge of all the churches in America, what small changes would you recommend? How do you think about navigating that tension?
Yeah, that's always a good question. I remember I was at a Willow Creek leadership conference once, and I was with another reporter, and I was just complaining about how they were doing everything wrong. And she turned to me and said, so how would you do it differently? And I was actually dumbfounded because I hadn't actually thought on the positive side. So I began to accept a lot of the things they were doing. Okay, there's really no other better way to do it. You've just got to do it. If you're working in a large church, you pretty much have to do that. You don't have a choice. So, there's probably a topic of another book, how I would do it differently. But let me just give some examples that I think can help. Boy, this is going to really tempt me to get going on this one. But I think one problem we have now, a part of the happy and more glib sense of the service is due, especially in Protestantism, is our temptation to turn the pastor, become a cult of personality. I mean, we live in a very, in an age that demands that the pastor tell us about himself. If the pastor doesn't mention a personal story from his life in his sermon regularly, people consider him an aloof and impersonal pastor. You know, when I went to seminary in the good old days, that whole idea of telling a personal story from your life was just coming into being. Up until that time, it was considered inappropriate for a pastor to talk about his personal life. Now it's inappropriate for a pastor not to do that. Okay? So I've listened to sermons in which the opening, unfortunately, I listen regularly to sermons in which the first word of the sermon is I, almost every week. You know, in the first sentence, there's the word I. When I was 17, when I was young, when my wife and I were first married, when I was with my kids at the zoo the other day, when I was Iowa. And the story's always interesting and funny. And then every point in the sermon is illustrated with a story from the pastor's life. It's personal and it's funny. And it becomes this kind of, we're here to kind of have a fun time getting to know the pastor and finding out about him. And it just lends a kind of an aura to the service that's like really funny to me. You'll notice the preaching in Acts as we go through it. They never talk about themselves. They just don't. They talk about Jesus all the time. Now, I think it's impossible, and I think it would be inappropriate to never talk about yourself in a sermon nowadays. People demand it, expect that we live in a story-driven age, a narrative age, a very personal, psychotherapeutic age, so they want to hear us tell those stories, and that's fine. But when they just become the point of the illustration for every point, there's something amiss. The other thing is the arc of our services are so frustratingly consistent. If there is not joy and happiness in the gospel, there is no gospel. My golly. Of course we have to have that. But I notice a tendency in some churches where, for example, in our church, we have a lot of music during the communion. And the communion takes anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes as people go forward. But the arc of that worship, of that music, is the same every week. It's kind of quiet and meditative to begin with, and then it begins to swell. And by the time we're done, we're clapping, and we're clapping in rhythm, and we're raising our hands. It's a charismatic church, and we're just all happy. And some weeks, that's the perfect thing that a church should do. And I love our church when it gets happy. There's no better church than Church of the Resurrection in Wheaton, Illinois, at getting happy. They're the happiest people, the God-driven, joyful people. We have to have a mosh pit during our Easter vigil at the end of the service. People are so excited. They're jumping up and down. They're waving because Jesus has been resurrected. It's quite extraordinary. But when that's all you're doing, is that the only emotional arc of the Christian life? Especially during Lent? Shouldn't there be a service that starts somber and stays somber? And we leave with a sense of the fear and the awe of the Lord? And we go out into our week? The first thing I would want to do is then examine the very kind of, in a sense, personality-driven, narrative-driven, psychotherapeutic things that tend to infiltrate our service with a sense. Because the psychotherapeutic world is all about making people happy. And anytime that whole way of thinking enters our church, the inevitable result was we're going to be working really hard to make people happy instead of giving them the gospel, which will make them happy a lot of the times. It should disturb them a lot of the times, but it should make them happy. And then think about the arc of our service in terms of our music. Those would be two things that come to mind immediately.
Hi. In your description of the human life in Eden, you describe it sometimes with images that I have normally associated with life after the so-called fall, the sort of animals eating each other, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
Nature red in tooth and claw, as it were.
Yeah.
And so I guess I've been sitting here thinking about how to frame this as a question, and I've failed. So I'm going to just ask you to say more about sort of the nature groaning under the weight of the law and the curse.
Okay.
Sort of like what's the difference between Eden then and life now?
Yeah, you've picked up one thing I was subtly trying to communicate, maybe not so subtly, but yeah, that poison oak and deadly mushrooms and the devouring animals are part of animals. I do happen to think that's part of the original creation. It's violent, it's bloody, it's disturbing, it's unnerving. But as I read my scripture and read, you know, the history of the planet, there doesn't ever seem to be a time when that wasn't part of the planet's life. And it fits with my notion of God being this unpredictable God who uses all sorts of odd and strange and uncomfortable things to carry forth his will. And so I don't exactly where I stop thinking as a theologian is that I'm not quite sure how that fits with other things, to be honest. I'm not having worked that out. But I think unless we have a deromanticized view of nature and see nature for what it is, I'm a fly fisherman, and fly fishing looks so cool. You wear the Orvis jacket, and you wear the cool hat, and you do the cool casting on a beautiful stream. But what you're doing is you're casting an imitation of a bug that wants to be devoured by a fish, okay? And that fish wants to be devoured by something else, and that something else wants to be devoured by something. It's a very vicious world you've entered all of a sudden. And yet it seems to me, I look at this whole thing and I go, wow, this is good. So I don't understand exactly how those things fit together, but at this point in my kind of theological journey, I'm not convinced, I'm somehow convinced that's part of the order that we're supposed to figure out and be a part of. And the deadly mushrooms are part of it as much as beautiful roses. Yeah. But I'd welcome some feedback. I know we have some people actually who are trained in theology here. It's the one thing I'm always intimidated when I talk. I like to play at theology. So I recognize that my theology is inconsistent at points, and I wouldn't mind having a conversation with someone that says, well, here's how you solve that, or you need to stop thinking that, Mark.
I don't mean for this to be a departure so much from what you were focusing on in your talk, but I'm curious, as we think about, you know, the Genesis narrative, and as you've depicted, and I think as the narrative depicts God as this, you know, active character, creator, unruly, you know, contrasted then later with, you know, books like Leviticus, Deuteronomy, where there's this heightened, almost crazy amount of detail and kind of reigning in of control. I wondered if you could speak about that.
Well, I've taken the book of Leviticus and just cut it out of my Bible. It doesn't really fit with this thesis, so. As I did make a comment just a few minutes ago, it isn't as if order is not part of what God wants to be a part of. As we all know, as good public citizens, you can't have a society without order. You just have anarchy. So although this talk will be showing the other side of order, the oppressive side, the side of order that turns it into slavery, there is a good and proper place for order. So I think Leviticus, the Ten Commandments, for example, Paul's instructions to the churches in his letters are all about order, you know. He says, there's got this fantastically wildly charismatic church, and he says, do everything decently and in order. Otherwise, it's going to create as many problems as too much order. So, for the sake of this weekend, that's true, but let's not think about that too much.
Well, since you invited reflection, I think there is a way to answer this question theologically, because what you've presented has been fascinating to me as I think about it, because we have to remember that the law was added after the fall, that this demand for control, for control was a protective measure because we had lost faith. And there's two ways of looking at the law, either that it is pre-existent of the fall and therefore extends all the way through eternity, or that it's a temporal aspect of the fallen world that someday will be ended. And what you've presented us with is an actual perfect Genesis explication of the law-gospel distinction as it relates to this narrative, because what we see is that the freedom of God doesn't require the necessary controlling aspect of the law in order for life to be fruitful. But because of our fear and the fall and the self-knowledge that it brought, we are given the law to drive us back to the cross, where at the end of time, this will no longer be necessary. And so what's fascinating is that this is why we, like I was saying last night, we can affirm the law, but only insofar as we know that it ends when we die. And by faith, we have died. And so this is how we can affirm everything that you said. And Leviticus comes in perfectly as what we must do to show us the God that we have lost concept of. Hmm. And we should have churches that need to be ordered, because given our own devices, we will only start sermons with I. And so, but all of these things no longer will be necessary when the perfect comes, as Paul says. But now we see through a glass darkly, and the dark glass has to be etched with the words of the law.
Okay.
So praise, that's very helpful. Thanks be to God that you have said this.
Yeah. One of the reasons I was looking forward to come here is you can tell from my writings and even this talk, I don't think the word law and gospel ever came up. I don't tend to naturally think in those terms, although I recognize what I'm saying is parallel with that. So I'm really interested to hearing how people talk about, use the language of law and gospel to talk about the same things I'm talking about, because it does bring up, flashes of insight come as a result. So thank you for that, John.
David, and then, did you?
Mark, what I heard in the knowledge of good and evil was the loss of dominion, that we were kings and queens, we were gods of this earth, but in seeking to be more, we lost that dominion, and that until we are really willing to recognize that we don't have the dominion and, in a sense, give it back to God, will we ever be alive again? That we did die, but that, and we did lose dominion. It was a gift to be like God's in His image, but that our desire to be more, a little bit more richer, a little bit more good-looking, a little bit more kind, we go in the opposite direction. We all know that we're what we are, and that knowledge is a frightening, terrible thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't read or thought about that aspect of it. There is, of course, some sense in which we still have dominion. I mean, we're responsible for taking care of the planet, taking care of one another, building communities, making sure people have enough food to eat. But we have lost dominion in the practical sense of it's really out of control now. You're inadequate to have the dominion that God intended us to have. And the paradox, of course, is we see it get out of control and we want to grab control of it more, and that only makes it more oppressive and more out of control at another level. And so it's a yes and no that we've lost dominion, yeah. We still have the responsibility of dominion, but we can't, it's like we've got the responsibility for it, but we can't fulfill it, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Question about chaos and evangelism. I live in New York City, so I spend most of my time at the front end of the evangelism food chain, talking about the gospel and living out the gospel to people who have never heard it. I've never thought about including necessary and good chaos as part of the message. Do you think we are leaving out something that is powerful and winsome if we don't make the message of the gospel quite so orderly? Are we giving it a false order when we throw out our four spiritual laws without adding in the warning label that this is a really messy and chaotic process?
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, a lot of the presentations of the gospel, they have a very kind of a simple arc to them. You're a sinner, you need to be forgiven, and if you're forgiven, you'll have peace with God. And peace means personal, existential, subjective peace. So on the one hand, we have to tell people, when you come to know Christ, life's going to be more disturbed than ever. So just, you know, fair advertising here. You need to realize that. The other thing is to help people already begin to recognize that the chaos in their life is not a result of their sin necessarily. It might be partially a result of that, but that it is God working in their life. I'm really upset. My marriage is falling apart, or I really have these questions that I can't seem to get answered. It's the evangelistic approach is not, well, pray and God will give you answers and settle this thing. No, it's, oh, so God's at work in your life. Huh. You should realize that God is at work in your life. Or when I was talking to a good friend of mine who was saying, I'm just having this crisis of faith. I feel pressured to believe, and I don't know what I'm supposed to be. You know, I believe because my family's always believed, and there's this big pressure to be a good Christian. And I told her, you need to stop practicing that religion. That's a bad religion. That's a really bad religion. And what God is doing, that God is taking you and weaning you from this religion. The reason why you feel so much pressure and unfulfillment is because God is now alerting you to the fact that the religion you're in is a really bad religion. Okay? And you need to give up that religion and start another religion. And you need to begin by looking at Jesus Christ, who is not a person who will pressure you. But he will love you in a way that's just extraordinary. So it seems to me that some of those are evangelistic tactics that can address the fullness of human experience in a way that understands that God is in every part of our lives, not just the good and happy and resolution, but the very turmoil that's there to begin with. Is the Holy Spirit's doing that in some way, causing that. And that's love. That's what love looks like a lot of times.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. That was just fantastic. I don't know about you, but I can't wait for the next part. Let's give him a round of applause again.